Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode, we go behind the scenes with Corey Hofstein, founder of Newfound Research and host of the investing podcast Flirting with Models. We are big fans of Corey's podcast and research, and we want to have him on to talk about how he thinks about podcasting, his goals with the podcast, how he prepares for his interviews, and other lessons learned from the multiple seasons of the podcast he's produced. Not surprisingly, Corey takes a very pragmatic approach to podcasting and the creation of Flirting with Models that I think you'll find very interesting. As always, thank you for listening to this special episode with Corey Hofstein, founder of Newfound Research and host of Flirting with Models. Corey, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, gents. Appreciate it.
So we usually have you on to talk quantitative investing, return stacking, or maybe doing a deep dive into your investment portfolio, but we're going to go a very different direction today. And we appreciate you coming on and agreeing to this, because what Jack and I have decided to do in the spirit of some experimentation, but also in talking with other podcasters and peers that we admire, respect, and sort of have been inspirations for us with Excess Returns, is talking to people like you who are podcast hosts and sort of going behind the scenes with how you think about your podcast, why you launched the podcast, sort of the nuts and bolts of doing a podcast. And I think, you know, Jack and I were talking about this before we jumped on with you, and it's like, when you're doing an investing podcast on a topic like return stacking, people obviously are interested in that idea and that concept. I think the people that are sort of will likely be very interested in this are the people that sort of follow you and follow the podcast and probably have often asked themselves, you know, how does Corey actually pull this off and actually do it? So, you know, for those people that have, you know, asked that question for the last couple of years, I think this is going to be a great discussion with Corey. And also just for anyone looking to think about doing a podcast, I mean, a lot of this stuff is going to be the stuff that you need to think about. So really cool that you agreed to come on and join us, Corey.
Well, I appreciate it. And before we get into all that fun podcasting stuff, in the spirit of experimentation, I just want to say I love the series that you guys do where you talk to investors about how they build their portfolios. I think that is one of the best questions you can ask any portfolio manager, because it really speaks to how they think about the world. And I love that series. I hope it's taking off for you guys, because I think it's one of the best series out there in investment podcasting.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it is. You know, our most watched episodes are pretty much all that now. You know, yeah, people like, and I've been really surprised, you know, at the beginning, it was like a little bit surprising about, you know, how do you get people to do it? So the problem is people think you're going to be like, show us your Fidelity statement and we're going to go through all your holdings. And so we had to demonstrate a few times how it actually works. You know, we're not going to ask you about your actual holdings. We're not going to ask you about the value of your portfolio. We had to sort of demonstrate that stuff. And so now it's easy to get people on. But at the beginning, I think it was like, you know, we're not doing this. I'm not telling you about my portfolio.
Everyone's a little nervous, right? Despite the fact we work in the money industry, money remains a taboo subject and they don't want to disclose too much about what they do personally. And I think also people are concerned that it maybe restricts them from potentially changing their mind in the future. But again, I think it's such a wonderful insight into how people think about portfolio construction, which is such an important topic. So I love it and I hope it continues and I look forward to listening to more.
That's awesome. Thank you, Corey. So let's go back to the start of your podcast. And I think you first started it in, I think, early to mid 2018, if I had my timing correct.
I honestly have no idea.
There you go. Well, I didn't look, so I know it was back then. Yeah. At least that's when you launched the first episode. So, I mean, walk us through your thought process on what initially led you to launching it.
So I had been writing a research blog, a research commentary for years. I wrote it weekly, pretty much without fail. I think if you went back and took all those research commentaries and compiled them together, it would be thousands and thousands of pages of text. And this was a year or two after Patrick O'Shaughnessy had launched his podcast. And really, you saw that accelerate with the launch of his crypto episodes. The guys at Ritholtz had launched a podcast, and you saw that taking off. I remember having a conversation with both Patrick and Michael Batnick at Ritholtz, and one of the things they both said to me was, look, there's an element to podcasting that can't be replicated just in writing. First, you need to acknowledge that people learn different ways. You can put all this great content out via text. If someone doesn't learn by reading, if they don't love reading, they're never going to care about what you said. If they learn by listening, you need to deliver the content in the way that they want to receive it. And then two, that there's a very different connection made with your audience when they can hear your voice versus just reading your text. And even though you don't actually know them, they feel more connected to you as the host when they hear your voice. And then eventually most people have moved to video when they start to see you, right? And those two things together at least got me to think, you know what? I'll try it. I'll try it for a single season. And I think my first season was just 6 episodes. We'll see how this works. And you know what? If it doesn't work, I'll pull the plug after that first season. And that's sort of what got me into it. It was just sort of this idea of experimenting with a new medium with which I could deliver content.
So I think I've heard you say this, or I've heard somebody say it, but it's definitely happened with me when I've had on my podcast feed, your podcast get populated in, and the title is Flirting with Models. And you know, my wife actually looks at it and says, "What are you doing? Why are you listening to a podcast that flirts?" I'm like, "No. This is a quant guy. Trust me." Yeah. And then thankfully, it's a cover image of like someone that you're having on, and not some hot girl in a bathing suit or something. So I don't really get in
hot,
trouble.
Some hot quantitative model.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you? I mean, it's a great title. It's a great play on words, and it captures like kind of what you're all about with quantitative investing, but how'd you sort of come up with that?
So funny side story before I tell you how I came up with this. I've been fortunate enough to get some big players at large institutions, and most of the institutions, when you start to talk to them, all right, they've got compliance and legal, and they've got their own marketing teams, and they want to get someone on that they can then use the podcast and promote it. And I went through the whole process of, you know, the pre-work with the compliance team, getting someone on, recording, editing, letting their compliance team listen to the post edit before I launched. And it finally got around to legal. And I guess the legal team said, under no circumstances will we be sharing this podcast with anyone. We're not going to prevent you from launching it, but our team will not go anywhere near this because of the name of the podcast. They were just like, we don't want our firm brand anywhere near the name of Flirting with Models. And I said, well, Adam, you must be an old stodgy firm with no humor. But because I never say which models I'm flirting with, right? Anyway, where did I come up with the name? I honestly don't remember. What I do remember is it was originally the title of a personal blog I wrote back in the early 2010s. It then became the name of my corporate blog at Newfound Research. So when I was writing all those weekly research notes, they were published under the blog name Flirting with Models. And then when I launched the podcast, it became obviously a natural extension to bring there. But I honestly cannot tell you where or how I came up with that original name, other than I just thought it was kind of funny because it was all my writing was always about quantitative models. It was all about trying different things and, you know, and another word, you know, play on words both with models and flirting, right? It was all about experimentation with these different quantitative models, and which is just sort of another way of thinking about flirting with them. So again, I think no one's lost on the double entendre with that name, but where it originally came from, I wish I had a better recollection.
It's funny that, you know, I think with a lot of the people that are in this sort of investing podcast space, you know, we started with writing first. And like you said, and then eventually, you know, getting into audio or getting into video and doing the podcasting. But I think, you know, the writing as quant investors, you know, we're obviously developing quantitative strategies and testing strategies and refining the process and building new strategies. But, you know, you also have maybe more time to experiment or pursue different things like a podcast or work it into the schedule, into the overall work. You know, that we do day in and day out. It's like quantitative investing by day, podcasting by night, maybe. But even though we're during the day here podcasting. So, but what do you, you know, when you think of like the mission of what your podcast is all about and what you're trying to accomplish, do you have any like North Star that sort of guides you? How do you think about that?
Yeah. So there's a couple of ways I think about this. I mean, the first is ultimately that what I'm trying to do is expose sort of the human factor behind the quantitative model, right? So you get all these quant factors. I'm trying to expose the human factor because ultimately there is a human. We always talk about quant process being unbiased. There is a human who's building this stuff and getting understanding what biases are being embedded, what views are being embedded. I think that's a fascinating process. Insofar as like, why do I do this? Look, I'm not going to say it's not a largely selfish endeavor for me. While I do at times sit in my ivory tower as an investment manager and researcher, I also own and operate an asset management firm. And it's the same reason any asset management firm publishes any sort of content. It's brand marketing, right? And so insofar as I can make people, I can provide them really good content and an interview series and get them engaged in listening to the podcast, and that gets some people to ask the question, who is Corey Hofstein and what does he do and what does his firm do? And that ultimately leads to business. That is the selfish end goal. But I'll also say for me personally, the other selfish end goals are I get to meet all these fascinating investors that I probably would never get connected with otherwise. That builds my personal reputation, but it also builds my network and the ability for me to have these guests on. And then when I'm running into an investment problem or I'm thinking about something that I know someone in my network is an expert on and I've had them on my podcast, it makes it really easy for me to reach out and say, hey, this is something I'm working on. Is this something you've come across before? Can you give me any leads? And so it's really helped expand what I like to call my outer brain, which is like just all the things my network knows that they're willing to share with me. Selfishly, the podcast has been really good for that as well.
Yeah, you touched on something that's probably been one of the biggest benefits for me of our podcast too, is if I want to just talk to someone in the investing world, it's a little bit weird to reach out and just, I mean, some people will do and say, let's just jump on the phone for an hour and talk. But we've been able to talk to people through the podcast that would have never said yes otherwise. You know, we're able to do it in the podcast format, and it allows us to learn and talk to so many investors that we wouldn't otherwise be able to talk to.
Absolutely. And ask all sorts of questions that they may not otherwise have entertained, right? I get to do really deep dives with people on their investment process and their thinking process and their methodology that ostensibly, like, one could argue people who come onto my podcast are actually competitors with me in many ways. Now, I tend to just, from a business perspective, take a very friendly view, like grow the pie for everyone. But one could argue, like, some of the insights people share with me and some of the stuff that doesn't even make the podcast, it's like, well, that actually is some secret sauce you're giving a competitor. But again, under the guise of the podcast conversation, that stuff naturally comes up. And I do find like a lot of researchers just like to be friendly with each other and help out. So if I'm writing a research piece, I now have a network of people I can send it to and get their collective feedback and thoughts on, which is incredibly valuable.
I want to ask you about getting guests, because one of the things you do a really good job of, you know, if you look at a lot of podcasts, including ours, you know, you'll see a lot of people that are on a lot of different finance podcasts. You'll see the same people coming around. But, you know, especially in your later seasons, one thing you've done a good job of is when I see your guest every week, I've typically never heard of them. And that's really good because, you know, they're typically somebody who has a lot of insights but has not done other podcasts. So how do you think about getting the guests?
Yeah, so I very purposefully try to avoid people that show up on everyone else's podcasts. Or if they are on everyone else's podcast, I very explicitly try to ask very differentiated questions. I'll make sure I listen to all their other podcast appearances or a bunch of them. And if someone wants to come on and talk their book, or talk about the same thing they've talked about on other podcasts, I usually just say no, I won't do it. Insofar as finding guests, I've found that that's gotten easier as the seasons went on. Early seasons, it was a lot of me going to my network and saying, hey, you know, I might get covered by a wholesaler at a certain firm because I also invest in ETFs at my shop. Like, are there any PMs at that firm that could be interesting? And then I'll try to network my way in. It's a lot easier now. The podcast has a bit of a reputation in the quantitative circle that I get people reaching out to me. And in fact, that's one of the harder parts now is I get people reaching out to me and I have to proactively screen them, and I'll do background checks and reputation checks among my peers and friends to try to figure out, like, is this person a good fit? Like, what's their reputation? So it's gotten a lot easier. That said, I still struggle immensely with getting enough women on the podcast. Representation for me has still been a huge issue. I think I still, if you look at, you know, all the cover art, I tend to skew white male, unfortunately. And I do try very hard to get as much representation as I can, but I have really struggled to get women on the podcast. So if you're a brilliant woman in the field of quant and finance, please reach out to me. I want to interview you.
Yeah, we've struggled with the same thing. You know, it's something we're trying to address too. We're doing our best to reach out to as many people as possible. Because obviously we don't want to just have, you know, male, you know, our audience, I think when I look at it on, you know, Spotify or something, is 95% male, but we don't want it that way. And we don't want our guests to be that way. So we're trying to do the same thing as well.
Yeah. And I will say it's a small industry. And a lot of the brilliant quants out there aren't necessarily great speakers. Or a lot of the brilliant quants out there aren't necessarily willing to come on a podcast. So when you start to talk about how many quants are really out there that are going to make an interesting episode, you start to talk about a pretty small subset of people. And I don't think I've gotten anywhere near, you know, through them. Like, it's not like I'm running out of guests, but it's not like a huge population. Because then you also get those people who might make a great guest, but the firm's compliance would never let them talk. Like, anyone at the pod shops, they're never going to talk unless they're on garden leave, right? So you got to get people at the right time of their career. You got to make sure they're at a shop that'll allow them to do this. Like, and so it starts to become a limited subset. And then you got to push back on the firms that are reaching out because they're trying to market something. And I've had that conversation before with firms that are saying, hey, we're launching a new fund. We really want to come on and talk about the fund. And I'm like, I'm not going to let you do that. I mean, we can get to discussing the fund, but like, you play by my rules on my podcast, and I'm fortunate enough that I can say that at this point.
Yeah, one of the, we've seen that too. Like, once you get a little bit bigger on the podcast side, you know, at the beginning we had zero inbound. Like, nobody wanted to come on our podcast. We were basically begging people to come on. But now, you know, you start to get all the emails on a regular basis, as you do. You probably do as well. And, you know, some of them are obvious. You know, if it's like, you know, John Smith is going to revolutionize the investing world and you need to get him on immediately. I mean, you know, that just goes in the garbage right away. But yeah. Then there's other ones that are kind of on the fence. You know, would this be a great guest for us or not? And we kind of deal with deciding that, you know, when that comes in.
Yeah. If anyone is listening that's trying to get on podcasts, my best piece of advice, by the way, is do not use a PR firm. They are horrible. That is an instant in the trash no for me. They do a horrible job picking the podcast to put you on. They do a horrible job with outreach. They do a horrible job of pitching your story. Just add the host on LinkedIn and send a personal message. And make sure you listen to a few episodes before you reach out to the host so you know it's a good fit. Tell the host why it's a good fit. They'll engage. But do not use a PR firm.
It's funny, like, some of these pitches we get, like, we have never covered anything reasonably close to the topic this person talks about.
100%.
Like, it's not even, if you spent 1 second listening to our podcast, you would know for sure you should not be sending it to us, but we get them anyway.
The PR firm just puts together a massive mailing list and they spam it, just hoping to get the person on a podcast. And it's a horrible way of going about it because it's incredibly impersonal and it's rarely a fit, right? It's just the wrong way of going about it.
One of the unique things you've done relative to us is you've taken a season-based approach, so which I'm a little bit jealous of because, you know, we're every week throughout the entire year, we're trying to be like, who's the next guest? Who's the next guest? So what do you think about that? What have been some of the pros and cons of that?
Yeah, so look, it is not the right approach if you're trying to grow a podcast. I have tried to use the in-between season as like build tension, but in the past, the way I've done it is I typically launch the season over the summer. Which is also a horrible time to launch a season because no one's around. Everyone's traveling, right? So I make all the wrong choices when it comes to growing my podcast. Really, when you think about what you're doing with the weekly episodes, is you're making sort of a trade-off of you're trying to get people to build a habit, but you're also trying to keep the quality high. Can you get enough guests? And so for me, my concern, and then can you pull it off? Like, that's a lot of work. I don't think people realize to do a good podcast how much effort it takes. I get burnt out, candidly, and I just knew this about myself. I cannot do a podcast year-round, certainly not at a weekly pace. particularly for the process I take, and just how much effort it just drains me too much, and it distracts me from other things I have to do. So I went for this seasonal approach where I start working in the spring. I try to pre-record as many episodes as I can. I start launching in May. Typically, I'm still recording later episodes through May and June. This year, I was and still am recording my sixth season, I guess, because I had a baby in between. And so like that knocked it all off. But so the benefit is I get typically 5 or 6 months off a year where I can just sort of sit back, and people will reach out and I'll say, great, I'll add you to the queue, and I can think about what I want my next season to be like, and I get to sort of relax. But I see this every time, the listener numbers drop way off, and it takes a while in the new season to get those numbers back up because people forget about the show. Or they don't know that the new season is coming, and then they don't notice the new season until 5 episodes have launched, or maybe they never notice the new season. And so from like a growth perspective, it is a really horrible strategy, because I don't think what I do lends itself necessarily to a seasonal format. Like if I were to say that, hey, this season's all vol, or this season's all trend following, or this season's all value investing, that would make more sense. But my seasons are just like Corey randomly starts and stops and calls it a season. It's not really a season. That's just Corey getting burnt out of podcasting.
You mentioned you have a pretty deep process. Can you take us through that a little bit? Like once someone's agreed to come on, what happens next? How does that process work?
Yeah, so the way my process works, and this is every guest has to agree to this. I will not do an episode unless they do this with me. I made one exception. And that's because I knew this person's work incredibly well. But I have them come on and I do an hour-long pre-call minimum. And that pre-call is important for two reasons. One, it allows me to sort of figure out what the passion topics are for the guest. It allows me to understand how they think and what they want to talk about. It allows me to sort of answer all the questions that I might have, brilliant and exceedingly dumb alike, right? And it lets me figure out which rabbit holes are worth pursuing and which ones aren't. And I think if that was just the podcast, people would be like, this is all over the place. It's scattered. It never got anywhere deep. By doing that, I can then spend the time to come up with a set of questions, typically 12 to 16. The other really useful thing about the pre-call for me is understanding how the guest speaks. It lets me pre-screen a guest to understand not only how long they take to answer a question, which if I'm trying to aim for about an hour long podcast tells me how many questions to write down, but also like let me understand the clarity of thought which they can communicate. And if they happen to be someone who's an incredibly good speaker, I can ask them incredibly complex questions and let them just go. If they're someone who's less of a clear speaker, a little bit more scatterbrained, I tend to make my questions shorter and more isolated, so that I can get a really specific answer out of them before moving on to the next thing. Because what I'm trying to do with that arc is allow myself to go deep, build whatever foundation I need, and then go deep into that passion topic that the person has, and then put a bow on it at the end. So it really helps me organize the arc of the podcast. I then send them the questions. For large firms, it typically has to go through their compliance or someone has to review it. Smaller firms, I'm just sending it to them to make sure they're comfortable with the questions. And sometimes I'll get feedback and say, hey, that's not something I'm comfortable answering on a podcast. Or, hey, I'd really rather talk about something, you know, something else. Can we reorganize these? I'll get feedback probably about 25% of the time. We bat the questions back and forth until we're both happy. And then we set up a time to record. The last thing I'll say is people will notice I don't do video. And I'm not sure I'll ever do video. The reason I like doing audio only, and when I record with my guests, there is a video because I think the video helps the conversation, but I only do the audio. And the reason I only do the audio is because I say to my guests, this will be as edited as it needs to be. Majority of the time, very light-handed editing, just cleaning up the audio. But I want the guests to know that if they are answering a question and they want to retake it entirely, or they want to cut a section out later, or whatever they need to feel comfortable that this is the best presentation of themselves and their ideas, we can do that in an audio format. In a way, in video, that would be very obvious and potentially jumpy. I have had situations in the past where I've cut out entire sections and re-recorded those sections and dropped them in. No one's had any idea. I've had times in the past where I've said to guests, I refuse to actually do that episode. I don't think it was the quality you want me to launch. And we're going to either we're not doing an episode or we're going to re-record it. And I think people would be surprised as to which of my episodes I've actually done that with. But again, my goal is to have my guests trust me that the output will be an incredibly high quality product for them that will put them in a very good light. The sort of last thing I'll say about the questions, and the reason I like to come up with the questions first and then give them to the guest, is so that the guests can trust where I'm going. Because for me to be able to go deep with some of the things I do, I don't want the guests to front run me. What I've found in the past is some guests will, if they don't trust you as a host, they want to make sure they get everything in. And so it becomes like word vomit. And you go, you just front ran six of my next questions. And now everything's thrown off and it's not helpful. Like if I give them the questions and they know I'm asking a question about X, and they just can stick to X because they know I'm going to give them an opportunity to talk about that important Y part in a couple questions, they trust me as a host to get there. Versus if they don't know the questions that are coming, they're more incentivized to just get everything out as quickly as possible, which I think leads to a worse sort of narrative across the arc of the podcast.
Yeah, we've had a couple instances where we gave the questions, because we give the questions as well. We've had a couple instances where we gave them, but they still answered them. You know, so like we start with like five, they know what the five questions are, and they answer all five in the first question. And then, you know, Justin and I are trying to scramble to figure out what to do from there.
And I will say, right or wrong, I will tell the guests, like, we're retaking that. You need to trust me as a host. I know you want to talk about these things. That's why I sent you the questions. You need to trust that I've done this 70 plus times. You have not done this. You need to trust me as a host that I'm doing it this way because I want to make you look as good as possible. Selfishly, people tell me all the time how brilliant I am. I'm not smart. I have smart guests on my podcast. And then I spend way too much time trying to come up with smart questions, but there's a halo effect, right? And I say to my guests, selfishly, I want you to sound really, 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 really good, because then people think I'm really good. And so don't worry. I gotcha. I'm not trying to catch you in anything. I'm not trying to get you to slip up. Like, my reputation is super important as a host. Trust the process, and we're going to get you a really high quality piece of content.
I think what you just touched on is the most important thing here, which is the end result is all that matters. The end result, and that it teaches people what we're trying to teach them, is all that matters. Because we have people who kind of question us sometimes on, well, why do you send the questions in advance? Won't it be more spontaneous if you don't? Or, you know, you talked about editing stuff out. You know, all of it comes down to what is that end product? You know, how we get there, I don't think really matters. You know, so, and that's why we send the questions. You know, we found even like big time guests have said to us, you know, I really valued that because I could think about the questions in advance. I kind of knew what was coming, and they could answer them without seeing them in advance, but they give more detailed answers if they know what you're going to talk about.
Well, but it can backfire though, where guests want to overprepare. And the one thing I will not allow a guest to do is read written answers, and guests will try to do that. And I have no issue if the guests want to, like, I've had guests get the questions and write their answers and send it back to me and say, hey, how did these answers seem? And I go, good, it's exactly what you said to me in the pre-call. So that's sort of what I expected to get out of you. Sometimes I'll say, hey, by the way, I'll send a question and say, hey, by the way, this is what I'm trying to get at. This is what I hope you talk about for this arc to make sense. Sometimes they don't talk about it, in which case on the fly, I have to come up with sort of an interim question to cross that bridge. But I've had guests who have written their answers and then try to read that on the podcast. And what they don't realize is that the way you speak and the way you write the way you speak are incredibly different. And if you were to read what you write, you sound incredibly robotic. It doesn't sound organic. It doesn't sound natural. And so what I've said to guests is, I have no problem if you want to come with bullet points. But if you want to read from a script, we will not publish the episode.
Yeah, no, we've had, I mean, I don't think we've had anyone read from a script, but definitely you can tell people when they over-prepare, when they have too much in front of them, it's not as good. Because like, to your point, it's obvious. If you're reading something off a screen, it's very obvious you're reading something off a screen.
Yeah, and probably much more obvious with you guys who do video. Like, again, with me, it's just audio, but I can tell in the audio, it is just less organic. The pauses are less natural. You don't hear them thinking, right? And the flow of the words, there's no filler words that are typically there. It sounds incredibly robotic.
Are there any major lessons you've learned about interviewing? Like if I saw Corey interviewing in the first episode and Corey interviewing now, like what are the biggest differences?
So one of the things that I did early on is I listened to other podcast hosts and I wrote down their questions, at least the structure of their questions. One of the things that I found, and this is my personal opinion, but one of the things I found I think good hosts do is they ask open-ended questions. No yes, no questions. It has to be open-ended. Typically, hopefully just one singular question or two or three questions on a narrow topic, right? Just the two or three questions might be ways in which you can attack that topic in different ways. But open-ended is really key. I think Patrick O'Shaughnessy is incredibly good at this. I don't know what his process is, but I think he's incredibly good at asking questions. Asking questions like, how do you think about this? Or, you know, just like, can you expand upon this concept? Those, to me, are the powerful questions. And I think early on, I was probably a little too narrow in my questions. I think what I've tried to do later on is be really thoughtful about making sure they're always how or what, never something that can be answered with yes, no. And that I think is something I've tried to work on compared to early seasons. I think that's probably the best answer there.
Yeah, to your point on the two-part questions, that's something I still do. It's you'll have the question and you'll be like, and add this other question to the end of it. And then inevitably only one of the questions gets answered. And, you know, I need to learn to like break it up, ask the first question, then ask the second question.
Yeah, and I definitely do that. Even though I pre-write my questions every once in a while, I'll still, while I'm giving the question, I'll go, I didn't think this went through enough. This should really be two questions. And I'll make sure, again, because I have the pre-written questions, if they don't get both points, I'll bring up the second point. But it's a little clunky. Again, it's something I'm always trying to improve on. But the open-ended questions, I think, is key. And then for me as a host, now that I create transcripts, my goal is that I always speak less than 20% of the time. Ideally, I'm speaking less than 15% of the time. I think if you're doing an interview, it is not helpful to interrupt the guest and interject your thoughts. I'm not here for a conversation with my guests. I'm here to get my guests' thoughts. So I think, again, it's the podcast I enjoy. The podcast I enjoy, respect the guest as the expert. They come and ask the question. And then you're not giving your thoughts in feedback. It's not a 50-50 conversation. I'm here just to ask questions and get you as the expert to teach me something. And so, again, I think that's something I tried to be good at from the get-go, but I think it's something I look at from a metric perspective. Like, I am super happy when there's an episode that I'm less than 15% of the spoken time.
So do you actually go back to the transcript and look at the percentage of words you said every time to see how that's how you're doing with that?
Yeah, so there's AI tools, right, that'll auto-generate transcripts now. One of the things they'll tell you is what percentage of the time you were speaking. Now, I have to admit, I tend to be a slow speaker. So if you actually look at the audio time, it's different than the word time because it takes me so long to say a sentence because I just speak really slowly. But I try to look at that audio time and say, you know, ideally I want to be less than 20%. It's to showcase the guest. And if I'm over 20%, it means I was talking too much. And some guests aren't comfortable with that. I've had guests say, I really want this to be a conversation. And I'll say, well, you're on the wrong podcast. I'm not here to have a conversation. I'm here to showcase your thinking.
I don't want to ask you to pick favorites, but I will anyway. Do you have any most memorable guests? You know, if somebody who's listening to us right now has never listened to your podcast before, do you have any episodes you would point them to?
Man, that's a good one. So I'm gonna barbell this. I mean, Cliff Asness was a really fun one for me just because I have such tremendous respect for him, the business he's built and what he's brought to the industry. Antti Ilmanen is someone who I chased down for years. And was a tough one because I did chase him down for years, and he was had a new book, and he kept telling me, "Hey, look, I will absolutely come on your podcast. I just want to do it when the time's right, when I really have something to talk about." And he had this new book, and then he did sort of the podcast circuit, and he hit everyone else's podcast before mine. And I ribbed him a little for it. I said, "Auntie, what am I supposed to do with this?" But that one was a fun one for me because it really forced me to. He wanted to talk about the book, which I can totally respect, but it forced me to say, "Let me listen to all the other interviews you've done and attack this from a totally unique direction." And then so that one sort of pushed me as a host. Like I could have done the very lazy thing, which is just like you could just flip anywhere in his book and come up with a question. I really wanted to attack it from a different angle. And then maybe Darren Johnson. You know, Darren is an independent trader who I don't think would think of himself as a quant, but he takes a very quantitative approach, totally self-taught programmer, totally self-taught in mathematics. And the opportunity to showcase someone who is, you know, doesn't consider himself a professional, but approaches what he does incredibly professionally and give him a platform to discuss these sort of things was... just when you look at the episodes, one of my most popular episodes and one I'm really proud of because it is very different. It's not getting some big multi-billion dollar firm. It's just someone managing their own PA, but doing it incredibly thoughtfully and giving them the platform to do it. So, those all stand out for me.
Yeah, I've listened to all three and they're all excellent. And I actually picked up what you said with Auntie because we had done, I don't know if our interview with Auntie was out at that point, but we had done one with him. And I'm like, Corey's going a completely different direction here, which is good because you did something that the rest of us did not do.
Yeah, I think I knew he had gone on yours and I knew he was going on Meb's and I knew he was going on Adam Butler's. And I knew Adam sent me his questions and I was like, these are like 70% overlap with me. Because they're all interesting questions, but I was like, how do I go? All this other stuff is going to be out there. How can I showcase something different and unique? And Auntie was one of those guys, and I love Auntie, by the way. Auntie is one of those guys who said, "Hey, I'd really love to have a conversation." And I said, "I'm not here to have a conversation with you, Auntie. Like, and I know you want to have a conversation because you and I go back and forth on emails discussing research topics from time to time. Like, it would be fun to have that, but that's not how my podcast works. Like, I'm really here to showcase you as a thinker. And let's really focus on that." So it was that one was a good, fun, challenging one for me. And again, one that Auntie is someone who's been such an inspiration for me as an investor and a thinker in this field that I was really happy that he wanted to be on the podcast.
How do you think about your stats? You know, I have a tendency probably to look at them more than I should, but I also have a tendency sometimes when an episode does really well to think, all right, we need to shift. I need to do more like this because this one did really well. Like, how do you think about that?
I try not to get too caught up in them. I sort of look at averages and I recognize that the world is changed pre and post COVID. There's a lot less commuting. And so there's a lot less time that people have to fill with listening to podcasts. So I just think, right, my expectations for podcast growth are very different. And I also look at it as saying, how many people in the world are truly going to be interested in an incredibly niche topic like what I do? I think we should eclipse 1 million downloads by the end of the year. I recognize I shoot myself in the foot by doing the seasonal thing. I don't build the habit, but I also hope that means I keep quality high and that keeps people coming back. But I can't point to episodes and say, oh, I did something right there versus I did something wrong in another episode. Sometimes there are episodes that I'm like, that is a phenomenal episode that just doesn't get the listens because it's not a big name person. And then other times, you know, the big name people are normally pretty darn good. That's why they're big name. But there's sometimes I'll do a smaller name person that I say, this episode has some really valuable thoughts in it. It just never gets out there the way I want it to. And when I'm publishing on a weekly basis, it just sort of gets swept out with the tide. At the end of the day, most of my episodes sort of on average minimum get about 7,500 downloads. The really good ones get up to about 15,000 downloads. But I haven't found like the growth to be continuing in an exponential manner. It kind of grows pretty steadily, but 10,000 downloads per episode, I'm pretty happy with that.
No, that's really good. I mean, you're definitely bigger than us. And we found the same thing. You know, when we have I can't really judge which guests are going to do well. Sometimes, I mean, some you can. Like, if Jem Kersan is coming on your podcast, it's going to do exceptionally well. He just has such a loyal following that, like, every episode we put out with him just has, like, 20,000 views on YouTube or something like that. But, other times, I can't figure it out.
It doesn't, you know, like, a lot of the hopefully the benefit of bringing guests on is they share it, and then those people stick around. And I love Jem, don't get me wrong. But what I found with Jem is his audience doesn't then stick around. They hop podcasts or whatever. They follow Jem, but they don't go, oh, he was on this podcast and I want to listen to other episodes of that podcast, right? Nor is his audience necessarily the audience I'm trying to hit. He has a large retail following, and I'm more than happy for people who are quant retail investors who want to listen to my podcast. Like, that's what it's there for. It's out in the public to make those conversations public. But for me as a business owner, like, I work with RIAs and institutions. Those are the people that I need finding out about me. Yeah, if Jem's listeners want to listen in, great. But they're not like, from a selfish business perspective, the people I'm trying to get in front of.
That is probably true. And that's something we probably haven't done as good a job of. Like, those types of listeners are probably not going to want to listen to us take a deep dive into value investing the next week. So a lot of them are probably going to see, all right, this is not an options-based podcast, and they're going to move on, you know, after they do the one episode. I want to ask you about the Pirates stuff, the Pirates of Finance stuff, because that's some of the best, like, the original Pirates of Finance stuff you did is probably the best thing I've ever seen done, like, on a finance podcast.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
It was so exceptionally good. And I'm just wondering if you could tell the story for people who don't know it, like, about what that was and how you did it.
Yeah. So Pirates of Finance, I think, was definitely one of these, like, COVID fever dreams. I think saying COVID gets you, like, canceled on YouTube, demonetized. I apologize. But it was definitely one of these, like, Jason Buck, my co-host, and I were really good friends, and we were just looking for something to do together. And we were both talking about, as great as a podcast is where you bring guests on, it can also be really difficult. Of, like, you can have guests cancel last minute. The guests might just not give you a good showing. It's hard to organize. It's hard to find new people. And we were talking about how the rest of the industry tends to not adapt as quickly to new media sources. YouTube, for example, like, as an industry, YouTube is, like, one of the biggest search engines, and the finance industry doesn't really put its content on YouTube all that much. And so we were saying, well, what if we did something fun? What if we focused on YouTube as the delivery mechanism? And what if we made sure it was not guest based? And so, again, during COVID, we just had some extra time, and we said, let's do these. I think we were doing it weekly at the beginning. Let's do these, like more well done, more edited, I don't know, stories. Like, we're going to have a topic, and it's going to be, yeah, Jason and I talking, but it'll also be us narrating, and we'll have more drop-in humor, and it's going to be heavily edited and more polished than just maybe a guest coming on. And it was a ton of fun and also a ton of work, but we had the extra time because we weren't going anywhere during COVID. And I think we did that for almost a year. I mean, I think I looked back, what is it, 2023? I think Pirates has been around for 3 years, and it's sort of gone through some iterations where we did a really heavy-handed editing, and people really liked it. And I love some of those old episodes. But then when the world got a little bit back to normal, Jason and I just didn't have time for it anymore. And so then we said, well, what if we sort of transition this into, like, two friends just chopping it up and talking at a bar? So we were on the Blockworks platform for a while, and it wasn't the right audience for us. They're more either macro or crypto, and we're neither. And then we sort of went to our own platform on YouTube, and the feedback was phenomenal. I mean, we had a great group of people that every Friday tuned in, and people said it was like listening to two friends just chop it up at a bar. And it was funny about it is, like, we called it the Pirates of Finance. I'm not sure we ever really talked about markets. Like, it was sort of everything but markets was the joke. It was whatever Jason and I just felt like talking about, ranting about. We were so compliance constrained, and we still are, that we just sort of talked about really random life stuff. We talked about going to conferences. We talked about travel. We talked about Jason not having more than 3 shirts to his name, and that's how he lives his life. Like, just really random stuff, and people seem to really enjoy it just as a break in life. we haven't done it in a while. And the candid reason is, one of the things Jason and I always sort of said is, why are we doing this other than just two guys having fun? Is there a bigger reason? It's not a show that ultimately helps our business. And if anything, it's probably a show that is risky to our business. And so with no real purpose or avenue other than just having some creative fun, I think we both agreed it was a bit of a distraction from the things we're trying to achieve with business. And it potentially is just a risk of us saying something stupid on a Friday afternoon that comes back to haunt us eventually in our industry. And so we said, you know, we've had a good time. I think it's time to sunset this for the time being. We might do some special episodes here and there. But for now, unfortunately, it is in a quiet period.
Jack, we finally found someone with less shirts than you.
That's true. I basically have the short sleeve t-shirts for the summer, and I've got the long sleeve t-shirts for the winter, and that pretty much is the entire podcast wardrobe. So
I'll tell you, Jason turned me on to these like merino wool shirts. I think he's got like two of them that his entire life fits in a small duffel. It is incredibly impressive, and he makes it work. I don't know how. I've got more shoes than could fit in a small duffel, so it's impressive.
Jack and I were joking around. We were actually going to reach out to Jason and have him come in like halfway through and like kind of surprise you here. But we just kind of said, we better not have any surprises. We don't know Corey.
I would have loved it. It would have been good.
Yeah.
But yeah, on that original pirate stuff, I mean, one of the things I appreciated doing a podcast myself is how incredibly difficult that must have been. Like the amount of work that goes, I mean, doing what we're doing now is not that bad, but you know, there's a little bit of light editing, you know, you got to put an intro on at the end, whatever. It's not that bad, but starting to piece things together into a puzzle and like put this interview part in here and then put this in here, it's like, it's really, really hard. I mean, that must have taken you a lot of time.
Yeah, there's always a learning curve with that stuff. Jason and I got to a point at the end where at the beginning of each week, you know, we knew the general arc and concept and story. And then what we would do is we would just record stuff and send it to each other. And I ended up doing a lot of the editing and just send each other content, send each other videos and images that we thought fit well. I would slap together a rough draft of an edit, get Jason's feedback, and then sort of polish it up. And I think we were doing like a Friday release schedule. I don't actually remember. But whatever it was one of those where like it was very collaborative through the week and very incrementally built. And then towards the end, it was polished. I remember the first week, it took me hours and hours and hours and hours to figure out the editing software. But I also had nothing else to do, right? I wasn't going out at night. We weren't going to restaurants. So it was just I had the free time. There's no way I could pull it off in my schedule now with you know, work travel and a baby and trying to have some semblance of a normal life with my wife. Like it just, there's no way we could do it now. But it was the perfect time where I could have that learning curve to get up to speed with editing. And then the later weeks, it was like we knew our format and we knew how to make the process work that ignoring outside of the just like the recording of content, the actual editing would take me 30 minutes to an hour. It really wasn't that bad at the end.
Yeah, but I would definitely, I'll hand it to Justin in a second, but I would definitely recommend anyone listen to it. Like there was one where you were like trying to find a package or something. I believe that was hilarious. Like you did a really good job.
So at the time I was living in Grand Cayman and someone had shipped me a package of rum. And as it turns out, if someone ships you multiple bottles of rum, it is not easy to get across customs. And so I had to go to FedEx, like, I don't know, 8 times to try to get this package of rum. And it was a real journey. So like, again, had nothing to do with the world of finance. It was just like whatever random stuff we wanted to talk about. That's what we were talking about. And it was fun, you know, a creative outlet for sure.
The Pirates of Finance were literally trying to find a hidden treasure.
Yes.
In absolutely. That package.
Yeah.
When you think to the tangible benefits that you've received as a business from the podcast, I mean, is there some that really stand out to you where like, okay, I'm talking to this guy specifically because he listened to the podcast? I mean, have you found that to be the case in some instances?
It's really hard to say. And maybe I just need to do a better job of asking people where they hear about me. But the way I think about our business is content creates sort of this gravitational pull. And you never know what the content is that gets people into your orbit as a business. Maybe it's a white paper you wrote. Maybe it's the podcast. Maybe it's social media. And the idea for me is they stay in orbit so long as you sort of have that continuous gravitational pull with content. And then eventually there's hopefully something that like either maybe an outbound call to them, or there's something that like knocks them from orbit into collide with you because they go, that thing really resonated with me and now I want to talk to you about a solution. So to me, that like it's very hard to quantify the ROI, because someone might listen to the podcast for 5 years and then it could be a white paper that ends up getting them to reach out. And it's like, how do I attribute, was it the podcast or the white paper? I will say there have been some, this is less tangible about the industry, but some other interesting experiences where I've had people recognize my voice or recognize me. So I was out to dinner with my wife and a young kid in university walked by and like was staring at me. And I was like, this is pretty weird. This kid want to fight me? Like, what's up with this?
Hopefully
like 10 minutes later. Yeah, we were at an outdoor restaurant. 10 minutes later, he walked back and he's like, are you Corey Hofstein? And I was like,
that's pretty cool.
This is really strange. And I was like, yeah, I am. And he turns to my wife, and she'll never let me live this down. He turns to my wife and he goes, you might not know this, but your husband is a mini celebrity. And my wife just died laughing. And I will admit, I'm horrible in those situations. I apologize to anyone who's ever come up to me. I am so bad in those situations. I feel so bad. But it's given me the opportunity is it's raised my profile to the point where people tend to know me to a certain degree. So if I reach out, it's not totally cold. If I'm trying to have a conversation with an institution or a platform, or I get invited to speak at conferences because I am sort of an entity at this point, which is a ridiculous thing for me to say, but like my name is associated with something that is decently well known in a space. And so therefore, right, that gives me certain privileges of further promoting myself in conferences and writing and social media and all that sort of stuff. And it all definitely has an impact on my business. Like I think, my team would tell you they have very, very warm conversations with folks because they know who I am and the content that we put out. But it's very, I don't know how you guys feel, but I find it very hard to quantify the ROI.
Yeah, in terms of quantifying the ROI, but certainly we've had conversations, and even recently, where like if people jump on with Jack and I, you know, it's sort of like we have a level of trust and credibility with them right out of the gate. It's not like we have to establish that. But with you, I could see, you know, you have Twitter, you have Flirting with Models. I know you're doing some stuff, which I think is actually very cool. I saw some stuff on LinkedIn with, it's like these mini return stacking educational videos that are kind of feeding the return stacking content strategy and educational initiative that you're doing. So it's all just like the ecosystem of content education stuff. Yeah.
And to that point of where people feel like they trust you and know you, like that goes back to the like very initial one of the initial questions you asked, where again I think Michael Badnick was the one who said to me, like, there's something different when someone can hear your voice, and if people listen to you long enough, they feel like they know you even if they've never met you. So and I would urge people to sort of think about like the celebrities that they've known their whole life. Like if there's a podcast you listen to all the time, or there's someone you've watched in the movies, like you will have this weird warm affinity to them. And especially like with podcasts, if it shares more personal stuff, like you will suddenly be like, I know that person. And you can approach them and feel like you know them and they don't know you at all. And that is probably one of the stranger parts of the interactions, is like, I'll have people come up to me and be like, I've been listening to you for years. How's your baby? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, you know a lot about me. I probably share way too much, but I don't know who you are at all. And it's a very asymmetric thing. Selfishly, that's great for business, right? Where they, you know, again, you're having those conversations and people really feel like they trust you and they know you. And hopefully that's for a good reason. Like you're not trying to mislead anyone here, but there's, again, selfishly, like that's that is what the podcasts are for. It's to showcase you and build that affinity and get in front of people in a way that maybe you wouldn't have gotten in front of them before.
You've kind of hit on some of the stuff that you do that, you know, some other podcasts might not want to do, like maybe the seasonal thing isn't great for growth, or some of the other stuff that you mentioned that, you know, maybe could be improved on a little bit or whatever. But that's just how you've decided to run and build the podcast. But do you have any other things you can think of that you would sort of tell someone starting a podcast from scratch, like advice that you'd give to them as a starting podcaster?
Yeah. So what I would say, again, another thing that shot me in the foot is not doing video. If you look at the stats, video is huge. YouTube is one of the biggest podcasting platforms, right? So the fact that I don't do video, I do have my audio on YouTube, but it's like, I don't think about it enough. I would urge people certainly consider doing as much video as you can. New podcasters, I would say, focus on audio quality as much as you can. Get yourself a nice mic. Like, people will literally turn off podcasts if the audio quality isn't good. Whenever I have a guest come on, especially when they're from a big firm and they sound horrible, I always think to myself, like, why is this massive firm not paying the $150 for a really good mic? Like, they're not super expensive, and it makes all the difference in the world to the listener. They will literally change how long the listener sticks with the podcast. And then the last thing I would think about is, like, you got to stick with it. You really just got to do it enough. I was very fortunate that when I launched my podcast, I already had an audience of people who were following my writing and following me on Twitter. And so I could bring a lot of that audience over with me. I think to myself today, if I was starting from scratch, finding that audience would be hard, but I'd be very thoughtful about how long can I do this consistently and how can I make sure the audience that should be listening to this is going to find it. What is that discovery mechanism? Because when was the last time you just went on to like Apple top charts to find a new podcast, right? How do you find new podcasts nowadays? Someone maybe shares something with you. Maybe it shows up in your YouTube feed as recommended, right? But you got to be thoughtful as to like, how are people discovering you? And if you're starting a podcast and you're not bringing an audience to it, like that has to be front of mind for you from day one, is how are people going to find you?
We're going to give you a heavy plug at the beginning of the intro. So, but what we want to kind of end it with is, you know, a lot of our audience, we certainly have a lot of financial advisors and professionals that listen to us. And, you know, we highly encourage you to follow Corey, subscribe to his channel on Apple or his podcast on Apple. Follow him on Twitter, go to Newfound Research, read his research that he's putting out, because it's all really good stuff. And so, Corey, we really appreciate you, you know, opening up sort of this behind the scenes, and we wish you all the best in future success in the business, in podcasting, and everything else. So thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Well, I really appreciate you guys having me on, and I look forward to listening to this new series. Hopefully you can get a whole bunch of the other podcasters out there, and I can listen and learn some tricks that I haven't picked up yet.
We're going to try.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarbonell. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.